This is a Doxcast, not an Argon Soxcast, or a Bendis and Loxcast. Now I'm hungry. This is a Doxcast. It's a nerdy Toxcast. Discuss a Moxcast with Rich Early and friends.
Hello, and boy, I totally botched that. That's staying in, by the way. That's going to go into the podcast when it airs.
Right. That's your signature move.
That's right. The false start is my signature move. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another unconventional episode of the Doxcast. I am your co-host, Josh Trumbo. Our regular host, Richard Early, is not with us today because he's out hobnobbing with other comic book artists in Portland, Oregon.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. He's got some nerve. But I am here with one of our podcast regulars, Brad Meixner.
That's me.
And we have a very special guest on this episode. We're at FM Comic-Con. Before I introduce you, I want to say we're at FM Comic-Con right here in Fargo, Moorhead, at the Ramada Inn. And this is very exciting. We do have the Comic-Con, one of the guests of honor here. Mr. Phil Hester is joining us.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Doing very well. How is your convention experience so far?
It's a blur because I literally just got here. I probably sat down for maybe half an hour.
So I'm sorry that we're going to peak
so
early and the rest of it's going to be downhill.
I'll just probably walk out after this.
Yeah. Okay. Just drop the mic on your way out and we'll be set. So this is really exciting. We on the podcast here, we've started getting a focus of getting in some guests who are professionals in their fields and the fields that we have a lot of nerdy interest in, including comic books and board games and things like that. And so to have you on is it's a real honor, and we're really excited to talk to you. So let's go ahead and get to know you a little bit better.
Okay.
For those of the people in the audience who might not know, and especially people listening on the podcast later, tell us a little bit about yourself and, you know, why are you here at Comic-Con?
You tell me that. I don't know why. Anywhere. My name is Phil Hester, and I've been writing and drawing comics for about 30 years now, starting while I was still a student at the University of Iowa. And I've worked for pretty much every American comic book publisher there is. I'm probably best known for having some long runs on Swamp Thing and Green Arrow, especially during the era that book was written by Kevin Smith. Mm-hmm. I've been kicking around the Marvel and DC universes for a long time. I co-created the Eric O'Grady version of Ant-Man with Robert Kirkman. I wrote a indie book called Firebreather that wound up as a movie on Cartoon Network. I currently draw Batman Beyond, and I also write a bunch of other little things on the side as well. I'm actually, what's coming out right now is I wrote a book called Future Quest Presents Birdman. It's one of those DC Hanna-Barbera books.
Right.
And it's being drawn by Steve Rood, which is pretty cool.
Excellent. So one of the things we like to ask our guests on the podcast here is we like to dig in and get a little bit of an idea of how you got your start. And I mean, we'll get to the point at which you got into writing and illustrating comics professionally, but we want to go back even further and see what it was, where it was in your childhood that the love of comic books got you and drawing and writing and how... Do you remember your first comic book?
Oh, I don't know if I remember my first comic book because they were sort of always laying around the house.
Mm-hmm.
I had some older uncles who, you know, read a lot of comics. But I can pinpoint exactly when I decided to start drawing my own comics. And it was, there was a cliffhanger issue of Iron Man. I think issue 118 or 119. This tells you how old I am. Like 118 or 119.
That's not after a renumbering change.
No, that's right? Original numbering. That's the Silver Age numbering. And Tony Stark was thrown off of the helicarrier without his Iron Man armor on.
Oh.
And he was plummeting to the earth, and he had to get his armor on before he hit the ground. And, of course, it ended on a cliffhanger. It ended on him being thrown off the helicarrier. And back then, you bought your comics at, like, Safeways and drugstores, and there weren't any comic shops. And if you were like a 10-year-old kid like I was, you didn't know if you were going to even get the next issue of that comic book. So I really wanted to know what happened to Tony Stark. So I just drew my own ending to that story. Because I didn't know if I'd ever get the real one. So I made my own little comic. And then it occurred to me, this is what those guys are doing. They're just way better at it. And if I want to get better at it, I should just keep doing it. And that's sort of where it kicked off.
That's excellent. Do you still have that?
No, by any chance? I don't.
Do you remember how it ended? I'm curious to hear.
The exact same way it did in the comic book. He got it on in time, and he flew back up and punched the bad guys out.
Perfect. That's probably the way it should go.
Yeah, that's probably the only way it can go.
I mean, clearly Iron Man's still going on, so he didn't.
No, he died.
That was the clone, Tony.
Yeah.
Every other Iron Man comic from here on out has just been blank pages and a cover. That's just to tease
people. Someone tell Robert Downey.
Yeah. Awesome. So that was the point at which you decided you wanted to do it. You realized you could do it. Because that's always a fun moment when you're a kid and you get that, because the world is your oyster, but somehow it doesn't occur to you that these things can actually happen.
Yeah.
Somebody makes these. Why can't it be me?
Yeah, I mean, I read the credits in there, so I knew human beings were making these comic books, but that's when I first made the connection, like, I like to draw, I like to write, maybe I can be one of those people someday, and that's when I made that connection, and I worked pretty steadily toward that all the way through, like, junior high and high school. I had, like, a pretend comic book company, and I put myself on deadlines, and, I made comics with my friends, and I was like, we're late on this issue of, whatever, like our BS comic, but we treated it like it was a real job. And I think that was a good training for, eventually working in comics.
Yeah, no, that's excellent, because that is one thing that I myself struggle with, and I see a lot of my friends struggling with, is meeting deadlines on personal projects especially.
Yeah, you have to treat it like it's your job. Mm-hmm. You have to be your boss. Otherwise, you'll always, let it go.
Right. It's one thing to say, well, no one's reading these, so what does it matter? Yeah. But then you train yourself, like you said.
If you want someone to be reading them someday, you have to act like they are.
Yep, exactly. So excellent. So you worked towards it. You kept on making comic books. When you were writing and drawing those comic books, did you create your own characters, or did you take the existing characters and create stories for them?
We created our own characters, but they were very thin imitations of whatever was out at the time. I had a Man-Thing comic, I had an X-Men comic, and they were all just sort of like shade off of the original brand.
Lieutenant America.
Yeah, stuff like that. By the time I got into college, I was creating stuff that I feel like was a little more original and a little more, from me and not just imitation.
Excellent. So following into college then, what did you study? Did you actually go in and study like in an art program or a writing program or even, a comics type university? Or did you go into like, okay, well, I'm going to have a backup here just in case?
No. Thankfully, my parents are really cool about it. But when I went to college, there was one place you could go to get a comic, any sort of comics related degree, and that was the Joe Kubert School.
Sure.
And that was too far away because I'm from Iowa and I still live in Iowa. And it was just like, that's not going to happen. But I went to the University of Iowa and got a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree in drawing, and with a big, strong emphasis on life drawing. Like, I was drawing the model every day. And if you're going to work in comics, you draw the human figure a lot. It surprises artists in other fields of art to see how much comic book artists self-generate in terms of how we draw a figure. We don't work from reference very much. It's all up here in our heads. And I got that from those years at the university, drawing from the model.
Yeah. No, that's an excellent point.
And it's also a place where I met a lot of people who came up with me and, became professionals themselves. We were all into comics, and we were all, again, making our own kind of DIY comics.
Sure.
And the people that you're sort of like, if you're an aspiring professional here at this convention, you can see them out in the hallway, in the dealer's room with their young upstart books. Those are the Brian Bendises of tomorrow. you know, because that's how we all start out.
Right. Yeah, and that's just doing it.
Yeah.
That's that.
As you bring it up, we have, you know, we do have the young artists, the young writers here. Mm-hmm. The convention scene was not that great when you first started.
It didn't exist. Yeah. Okay. Well, no, it did.
San Diego might have been in second year.
It was
maybe.
San Diego, Chicago, New York, and
yep.
that was pretty much it.
And that's where.
And now we're Fargo, Cedar Rapids. You know, yep. Like every town over like 100,000 has a con now, which is pretty crazy.
So how did you get yourself out there? Since yeah. you know, because now at the cons, if it's a big artist or a big company, you can go, you can show your work.
Yeah.
You can get just here's a script. If you like it, call me. How did you get yourself out there?
Well, I did go to Chicago. I did go to the Chicago Con a lot. And back in those days, the Chicago Con had a dedicated room. A lot of people can't believe this, but they had a dedicated room where the editors just sat in a line, and you could bring your portfolio
oh,
and
wow.
just go down the line. And I spent the whole day in that room getting portfolio reviews. And they were brutal, but I learned a lot from them. But also, it was also a time when comics weren't such a big multi-billion-dollar business that editors would read the mail. So, if you sent them a submission, they'd actually look at your artwork and they'd like respond and give you pointers and tips. And so, I had this big stack of rejection letters from about age 16 to 20, and there's great advice in there, and it's all from people like you know Jim Shooter or you know. People at Marvel or DC, Dick Giordano, John Buscema, all these guys really laying on the, you know, the facts of how to make it as a comic book artist.
That's great.
Yeah. That doesn't happen anymore. If you send them a cold submission, they don't really respond anymore.
That was going to be my next question is yeah. how much of that interaction that, you know, occurs these days?
Not much. But the trade-off is you are able to go to conventions and meet a lot of, if not editors and publishers, at least other artists, mm-hmm. and get feedback that way.
Right, and sometimes they're on panels
yes.
where they give out lots of great advice. So,
or middling advice.
No, let's not sell ourselves short. when you were taking your portfolio through, and did you originally want to get into more of the art aspect or the writing aspect, or was there just kind of a mm-hmm. I just want to work in comics, you know, did you have treatments or scripts
yeah.
that you took as
a little of all the above? I just wanted to be in comics, and I first wanted to be an artist, writer artist. Those were my heroes, like Jack Kirby, Will Eisner, Frank Miller. Those guys who did it all mm-hmm. were sort of my heroes, and that's what I really wanted to do. But I would have been a letterer, colorist, sales rep, whatever it took to get in. I really love comics. But it just so happened that my skills as an artist were more commercially viable before anything else. And so that's where I started at. And that's how I broke into the industry. But I should add, when I broke into the industry, it was super easy to break into the industry. It was about the time that the Turtles kind of broke through in comics. Mm-hmm. And everyone saw what Eastman and Laird did with the Turtles, and they were like, oh, these guys just slapped together this comic, and now they're millionaires. I have a credit card. I can do that. You know, so overnight, we went from, like, you know, a handful of publishers to, like, 30 publishers. And the talent available to them was really small. Small enough that they, you know, looked at a sophomore going to school at the University of Iowa and said, yeah, you're hired, kid. You know, so
sure.
That's when I start working.
Well, now with especially with the internet, so the internet kind of replaces a lot of the old, you know, the mail-in
yeah.
submissions and stuff like that. How easy is it to get noticed? Do you have any thoughts or anything?
Well,
I
think talent always finds its way. You know, talent always rises to the top. You see a lot of people that just post stuff on Instagram or Twitter or, you know, Tumblr or whatever, and it's really incredible work, and it leads to them getting professional gigs, mm-hmm. Which is pretty astounding. It's something I couldn't imagine. And, you know, there's also people that are sort of like playground legends. They're great on Instagram, but then when they get, you know, when it's time to do a book, they can't quite manage it. But, no, it's a great place to really discover new talent.
Yeah, and it definitely helps in the way that you don't need to necessarily pay money, you know, to publish a book. You could make a web comic and
that's
put
the
it
best,
out there.
That's the most exciting thing about what's going on right now is, like, when I started out, people were, like, you know, scraping together a few hundred dollars to print these crappy black and white comic books. But now you can do whatever kind of story you want, whatever kind of genre, and just put it out there on the web. And what's cool, I mean, it's a double-edged sword. You can reach a lot of people that way, but it's very hard to make money that way. That said, there are people that, if they build a dedicated audience over years and years and years, and they really put the work in, and you get a book like Girls with Slingshots or Octopus Pie or something like that, where there's a web audience that's been really loyal and built, and then when you put out a collection, you'll sell, you know, thousands and thousands of those of that collection. So it is a viable way to go. Not everybody has to draw Iron Man, you know.
Right.
Not anymore.
You've touched on, you know, like you said, you've worked for pretty much every major American publisher. Does that hurt with you when you have to write a pitch? Because you're like, all these, you know, mythos have blended together. You know, can you keep your DC history straight to make sure that you're, when you're sending in your pitch, you're like, and Pepper Potts walks through. You're like, Pepper ain't in our universe.
Right.
You can use her.
No, I sort of, I like to think of the idea first and then find the characters that'll fit it. So a lot of times, this works both ways. A lot of times the indie books I do are Marvel and DC pitches that didn't work out.
Sure.
And then sometimes the Marvel and DC stuff I do are indie ideas that never came to fruition that I kind of think, oh, well, that might make a good demon story, you know, and so I'll go do that. Or this would be a cool Ant-Man story, whatever. So that's sort of how it works. I think that's one of the other things I try to tell young creators is to stay flexible with your talent and your vision. Like, it's cool to be, like, really focused on what you want to do and go do it. But not everybody's going to be Jeff Smith, where you just, like, you emerge from the womb and make bone, you know, from the beginning. Like, not everybody's going to be like that. But you need to be flexible. So, like, entrust your creativity to take you wherever it's going to take you. And certain opportunities are going to pop up that you didn't anticipate. But if you trust your creativity, you'll find your voice that way.
Do you ever regret, you know, like, the big thing that we've seen is all these creators in the early 2000s started creating all these characters that then exploded. Mm-hmm. And then they're like, why did I give that idea to Marvel or DC? You have created Eric O'Grady, who I think would make a fantastic Netflix series.
Yeah.
You've created El Diablo, who has now been on the big screen.
Yeah.
You know, do you ever feel like, well, I just gave that character away and look where it's gone?
No, I have no regrets because, well, for one thing, both those characters are somewhat derivative. I mean, Eric O'Grady's just another Ant-Man.
Well, yes, but
my favorite, but he's just another Ant-Man. And El Diablo is a big reimagining, but it's a reimagining of an old Western character. So, I think in general, most creators are a little bit cagey about that, about creating something for Marvel or DC. But nowadays, Marvel and DC know that, and so they try to take care of you. If you do create a character in the course of working on a book, like I created a few villains for Green Arrow during the time I was working on Green Arrow, and they wound up on television, and I do get compensated for that.
Sure.
I get compensated for when El Diablo's in Suicide Squad. So, DC especially has made a big point of trying to take care of their creators that way, in the hopes, I think, that they won't be so gun-shy about creating new
Do you feel properties. That the representations, either on TV or, you know, movies, when you don't have a direct hand in it, do you feel they've stayed? Can you tell that is your character?
Not really.
Or is
really.
It just like that costume kind of looks like it maybe, sort of?
Not really.
Okay.
I mean, but that's okay with me. I realize there are different mediums and it takes different. I have to say, like, the one thing that got directly adapted from my work, Firebreather by Cartoon Network, really hewed really close to the original concept.
Were you involved with that? A lot?
Not a lot. They pretty much showed us the screenplay and they asked us to solve one of the problems in the screenplay and we pitched in on that. But other than that, it's mostly the vision of Peter Chung, the director, who I think is a brilliant director. He created Aeon Flux for The old people here who know what Ian Flux is and Phantom 2040 and a bunch of other cool properties. So I was a fan of his. So, like, we just put ourselves in his hand and let him do his thing.
And since you're from Iowa, so I assume maybe Tony flew you up here. Maybe you drove.
No, I flew this one. Right. This is just outside of my driving range.
Yeah. You didn't want to put in the 8 hours?
Yeah, it would have been a little bit more than eight, maybe. I'm in eastern Iowa, so it's...
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Now, when you're at all these conventions, you know, you've written... You have a little bit deeper well that you've written from or drawn from than a lot of the new up-and-comers.
Yeah.
Are you ever shocked when someone brings you a book to have you sign? Or
oh,
it's
yeah.
just like... I didn't actually think this was still in print or that
oh,
anybody
yeah.
knew it existed.
No, the thing that really gets me is when a grown adult brings me a book and says, this is my first comic book. And I was like, in my mind, that just came out, you know. But they're like, this got me into comics. And I'm like, how is that possible? You're an adult. And I just did this like 3 years ago, right? But no, it was like 13 years ago.
So you've been going to too many conventions. Time's just blurring into
yeah,
one constant
it's all,
for you.
That happens when you get old. Okay. Just like it all, like in my mind, Radiohead's a new band.
You know? There's a lot of puzzled faces in the audience. I feel old too.
You're writing, you're drawing. Mm-hmm. You've also got some credits as inker and colorist, I assume, on your own work.
Yeah.
You know, so that's, you know, the Tony, the Academy Award, and the Grammy. You're yeah. pretty much doing it all.
Yeah.
Which of those do you find to be, you know, your most stressful, and what is your least stressful?
I think writing is easier than drawing, for me anyway.
Because you don't have to put all the effort into the panel? You're just like,
well,
I would like this to happen in the panel?
Yeah, it's
make
much
it just
easier.
Go do.
Listen, it's easier to describe some things than draw them. It really is. And what is considered the hard part of writing is coming up with the idea and sort of like making it meaningful for the character. But that's sort of daydreaming. You know, that's something I do anyway while I'm drawing. So it's just physically less taxing than drawing. So I would say writing's a little bit easier. They're both very gratifying. But I'd rather write more and draw less.
You have two current books, one you're a writer, one you're an artist on.
Mm-hmm.
Do you split your time 50-50 in a day, in a week?
Oh, no. Drawing is so much more labor intensive. It has to be, like, if I split up a week, it would be a day of writing and, you know, 4 days of drawing. A work week, anyway.
And are you still, you know, in my mind, I started in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. You know, I can still picture those like test yourself books, those oversized, what were they, like 17x24s uh-huh. or whatever, where you got like the panel.
Yeah.
Do you still do that, or are you completely digital with your art
oh,
style?
No, I still draw old school. I draw on paper. I'm one of the few, I'm one of the holdouts. So.
And then what is the process from there? Because I highly doubt your inker and colorist, if you're using them, are also in Iowa.
I do have an inker in Iowa, to be honest. I have an inker that lives 24 miles from me. So the guy that inks Shipwreck and I, we meet at McDonald's on the interstate. And I hand him, it's like a drug deal. I hand him the pages and he goes
That is the
away
most professional sounding interaction I've ever heard.
Yeah.
That is very cool.
At
though.
Least it wasn't a rest stop on the interstate. But yeah, we just, you know, meet and pop our trunks and
you sit in booths next to each other
yeah.
and just sort of slide
just
the portfolio
leave it there,
back
walk
to
out.
Him.
No, but for the most part, we still do the pencil and ink on paper because I love original art. I'm a big fan of collecting original art, and it kind of breaks my heart that like so many artists now are producing really amazing work that doesn't have a physical presence and can't be collected, and I just can't give that up. And also I think all my years of art school, you know, there's certain artists that are like, you see him work, like a Kim Jong-ji, you'll see him start in one corner and like end at the other corner. It's like this brilliant Jack Kirby worked that way too. It's like they have a projector in their head and they're projecting on the page and then the pencil's just filling it in. That is not me. I have to like get into a drawing and struggle with it and battle with it and lose it and get it back, and it takes a lot of work, and it's like it's an actual physical ordeal, and if it were digital, that that would take too much of that struggle out of it. Like if you could just click undo,
right?
The struggle is sort of gone, and I all those years of life drawing, to go back to, you know, bring it full circle, all those years of life drawing in university were about, like, enjoying the, learning to enjoy that struggle and finding, that's where, like, the real truth of a drawing comes from.
So when you have when you have a panel, you don't want to start over. You would like to...
Yeah, I will rework it until it works.
Rather than just get a whole new panel, fold that, crumple that one up, throw it away. You would not...
Yeah, that's very... I very rarely do that. I probably should do it more, but very rarely.
Well, there's a... I think there's a certain thing to be admired in that, because you know, I do a bit of artwork and stuff myself, and I do it all digitally because I have to have layers and test things and do this.
Well, I mean, some people are wired for that. I'm just not wired for it. Yeah.
But I definitely have admiration for someone who can sit down and actually work through and create that in on a real, you know, a canvas or a board or a, you know, page, whatever. So yeah, that's cool to hear that, you know, you're still working that way. So do you have any kind of a process when you sit down to create? I mean, do you need to, like, have some scented candles or something, or music playing, or what to, sit down in the bathtub and draw?
When I'm writing, I need silence or like, truly ambient music. And when I mean ambient, I mean, like, no beats, like space music.
Whale sounds or something.
Like, it has to be very, very ambient or classical. And then when I'm drawing, I'd rather, like, hear people talking. So I'd rather be listening to, like, a baseball game or sports radio or late-night conspiracy radio, whatever. Just, like, whatever is going to keep me up and engaged and working.
Art Bell or George Murray.
That's right. Yeah, those are my guys.
Coast to coast.
Jimmy Church, all that.
Yes.
If I can hear a human voice when I'm drawing, but, like, when I'm writing, I need that silence and... And it's the same way, like, just in terms of interacting with people. I can't write with other people in the house. I can draw, like, on a bus, but I can't write with other people around and needing something from me. So.
I don't know how often, how many conventions you have scheduled yourself for 2018, but do you ever, I mean, do you... You know, as you're traveling, you're just, like, an idea pops into your head. Somehow you see something in an airport terminal, and do you have the time to write that?
Oh, yeah.
Write that down?
That's happening all the time. And I think if you talk to any creator, they'll tell you that. That's happening all the time. They're always, like, either jotting it down or speaking into their phone or whatever to remember to, you know, incorporate something that they've been inspired by. Yeah.
When you've had those flashes of inspiration, what is the, like, the longest... You know, like, you just have this singular thought, like a 5-minute thought,
it was
and how
the
long
worst.
Have you been able to write that into, like, can you get 24 issues out of that
hear
thought?
You want to hear the very worst thing that ever happened?
Yes.
Like, I was at a convention in Calgary, and I was just wandering, there was a long way between, like, the Saddle Dome where the con was and our hotel, so I was walking, and I had this really great idea, and I'm like, I got to get home and write that down. And I wrote it, like, I filled up, and I didn't hit, I didn't even bother to get my own work. I just grabbed the hotel stationery out the nightstand, and I just scribbled, and I filled, like, 4 pages of it. I'm like, this is a real winner. This is going to be something special. And then the next day I read it, and I'm like, I just wrote Memento. That was Memento. And I didn't know it. You know, like, I'd forgotten I'd seen Memento or something. But, like... Yeah, I was just like, oh, no. Sometimes your inspiration can betray you.
So how is it difficult to separate? You know, there's the saying now that there are no new stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything's been told. When you're writing, and maybe even when you're drawing, if you're creating a character, how difficult is it to come up with concepts, at least that pass your own personal...
Right. Well, I think anytime... If you're making up a story, even if it hews close to something else... It's still you, you know, it's still your story. And I think that I believe the opposite in that I believe every story is a new story because the person who's telling it is a new person. So seeing that person's take on it is exciting to me as a reader and a creator. So, but occasionally there'll be some nutty coincidence where, like, you'll make something really great up and something else just like it will come out and beat you to the punch. I mean, that happened to me explicitly with You guys know those Lightning Thief books?
Oh, yeah.
Percy Jackson?
Yeah. The Percy Jackson books, yeah. I mean, I had that exact idea and was pitching it as a... he wasn't named Percy Jackson. It was about like...
that would have been a little weird.
It was about like the next generation of demigod kids, you know, all sure. figuring out they were demigods. And I was pitching that around at comics places, and an editor called me and goes, "Dude, this is awesome." He goes, "But there's a book coming out that sounds just like this." And that's just the way it goes sometimes. Just got to lump it and move on.
You never would try to... Because if you have this stuff written down, if you have dates, I mean, you can prove that you're not
stealing. Oh, no, I would never.
Stealing. You just,
it doesn't matter.
You think it'd be too close?
It doesn't matter because, like, if something succeeds, it succeeds. Like, if it beat you, you got to take it. And if there's something good about my idea, and there was still good stuff about my idea, and it did wind up in a book I created called Mythic, which was like a completely different concept. But the good parts of that you usually can salvage and reuse somewhere.
Well, we're coming up about 10 minutes left for this. Brad, I'm going to ask you if you have any final questions here, and then we'll open it up to the audience if you guys have any questions for Phil. So, Brad, do you have another good question?
I guess my last question is, you know, I was going through your bibliography, mm-hmm. and it's very weighty, it's, you know, making sure that I'm tracking down. And then, you know, just things that are popping up. Back when I was young and early and I, you know, didn't keep track of my creators as well, it's yeah. like your name was popping up to all these things I've read.
Yeah, I always tell people I'm in your comic collection whether you want me to be or not.
Is there a character, you know, you've had your runs, your mm-hmm. long runs. Is there a character that you've only touched for an issue or two, maybe just an arc, but sticks with you? It's like you had so much fun on that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's characters that have longer than an arc. I mean, I drew Swamp Thing for 3 years, and I would go back and do it again tomorrow. Like, that's one of the few characters I feel that way about. I drew the Hulk in a few issues, but I really enjoyed drawing the Hulk, and I'd like to go back to that. Usually I'm drawn to the monstrous kind of characters,
sure.
and that's more fun for
that
me.
That are apparently green.
Yeah.
Or wear green.
Green Arrow, yeah.
Fire Breather was so outside your wheelhouse. Yeah, like, this guy's going to be orange and red. Yeah. Be like, what? No.
But yeah, I don't know why I keep winding up on green. And I had a long run writing Green Hornet too. So, yeah, I don't know what that green.
Are
thing
you is. Color cast instead of typecast
as
a writer?
Yeah, there might be something to that.
Getting down to the
now, you have to just give Batman here. Beyond a green
a
outfit.
Green, yeah,
just sneak it in there.
Just to
give him the Green Lantern ring. Will they let him
to
do it?
Come full circle.
All right. So, yeah, we'll go ahead and open it up here. If you have a question, feel free to raise your hand. We'll call on you. I'll repeat the question so that we make sure we get it onto the podcast.
Don't be
here.
Shy.
And, yeah, feel free. Any questions
you could
at
ask
all?
A stupid
oh,
question.
I have one over there.
Who was the first character you've ever made?
The question is, who is the first character you've ever made?
Well, that's it'd be embarrassing for me to tell you that because it's so lame. You mean like when I was a kid, or like, well, the very first character I made a comic book out of was a character called the Black Destroyer, and he was sort of like an even cooler Iron Man, except for his armor was black and white, so that's why I called him Black Destroyer, because he had more black in his armor than Iron Man does. But he was really. And he had a buddy named Windsor who was, like, super fast. But, yeah, I was, like, 10. So you got to forgive that.
So we won't expect to see
no,
a
those
new
guys
episode,
aren't coming
new issues
back.
Of Black
those guys aren't coming back, no.
You don't have an anthology in the work?
No.
Okay.
You know, there was an anthology. Like I think Tim Seeley was like, we all need to do, like, an anthology as the pros we are today of our first dumbest idea. Like, we need to do, like, so
you
I would
know
have
that
to do
would
the
sell, though. You know
oh,
that
absolutely.
Would sell.
It's a great idea for something.
Any other questions? Anyone else?
I can see people that are almost ready to ask a question. I can see their body language.
Well, one thing I'll throw question. In there real quick while people are gaining up the courage to speak up. So when it comes to creative teams, do you have, you mentioned, you know, the inker who lives close to you, mm-hmm. do you have a lot of say in, or when a team comes together, Or how does that process work? And I know it's very different, I'm sure, between companies and creator-owned stuff.
It seems like nowadays I do. I mean, part of that is the image revolution and, like, creators calling shots there. Mm-hmm. When I started at DC, like, the guy that's inked me the most is a guy named Andy Parks. He inked me on a ton of stuff. And we're about the same age, and we both sort of broke in at the same time. But DC would not put us together. Like, even though we wanted to work together and we saw ourselves as a team, they put him on other pencilers and they put other inkers on me. And it wasn't until Green Arrow, really, that we got, and we were, like, in our 30s by then, that we got somebody to listen and put us together on, like, a DC book.
Was that because did they put you with other experienced
people? Yes.
And so they didn't want two newbies on.
And also, there's also this... especially at DC at that time, there was definitely sort of like a level of professionalism. Like, just because we're switching pencilers on a book, we're not going to fire an inker. Hmm. So, like, my inker on Swamp Thing was Kim DeMolder, and it wasn't because they thought Kim DeMolder would look good on me. It's because they were not going to fire Kim just because a new penciler was coming in. Hmm. And that was the same thing with Andy. He started inking Catwoman. And it was just a matter of, like, well, Jim's still the penciler, so he's going to stay on it. So that's how it worked.
Excellent.
We have a real question.
Oh, we have a question. Oh, so he's asking what really influenced you? Were there any other influences, and what got you into comics? We talked about that a little bit, but
I was always a comics reader, even when I was really young. And when I was into comics, you could buy them anywhere. Like, they were everywhere, and they came in, like, these three packs. You'd get, like, three comics to one little bag, and they'd hang them on the racks at, like, TGNY or Safeway or, like, any, like, whatever kind of, like, dollar stores are today, like stores like that. And so you didn't know exactly what you were going to get, but you know you get three comics. So, and that was exciting to me. And I saw a bunch of comics at that about that age that really had a huge impact on me. I saw a comic book called E-Man, which was, like, a really cool, like, it was a really, like, bright, happy, kind of bouncy superhero character. And I love that guy's art, and that sort of, like, that's sort of why my own work now is sort of cartoony still a little bit. And at the same time, I also saw... The Swamp Thing, back when Bernie Wrightson was drawing it. So that's why my work is this big mess, like a combination of, like, dark and creepy and, like, bouncy and fun at the same time, because I've got those two different poles that are kind of pulling at me at the same time.
Excellent. Good question. Yes?
Have you ever thought about revisiting your older comics or stories and thinking, oh, I can do that better?
So the question is, have you ever thought about revisiting your old comics, your old stories, and with the attitude you could do that better, you could improve?
Oh, yeah, all the time. I want to redo anything by the time it's come out, you know? So, like, by the time a Batman Beyond has shipped, I can't look at it. So I always want to redo everything. But also, I have characters that I really loved that, like, nobody else loved. And I'm like, well, I really think I'm going to give this guy another shot, and maybe people will like it. They won't, but I'm stubborn. I still like it. I did a character called The Wretch a long time ago, like 20 years ago, and it got nominated for an Eisner and everything, but nobody bought it. It was, like, really poor selling book. But what I found out later, like, when I talk to professionals now, the guys who are, like, 15, 20 years younger than me, the people who did buy that book are like, professionals now. So it was sort of like... it wasn't ever a hit album, but the people who make hit albums now bought it back then, you know. So it was kind of, so I'd like to go back to that character and do some more stuff with The Wretch. Yeah, in fact, I am. I'm doing a new story with The Wretch right now.
Awesome. Any other questions? Time for maybe one or two more, if anybody has one. Yes.
In your opinion, which do you like better?
Oh,
that's
so
tough for me because I'm going to give you, like, a too detailed answer, okay? I was a Marvel kid growing up, like 100% Marvel kid growing up, because DC Comics seemed really old-fashioned when I was a kid. Like, Superman looked like he was 50, you know, and he was like your, he looked like your gym teacher in a Superman outfit. And everybody in a DC comic was saying or thinking exactly what they were doing in the picture. And to me, that just seemed like too simple. So I was always a Marvel guy, like, and I love those weird characters, like, you know, like Spider-Man's kind of weird. I mean, he's a little bit weird. And the monsters that Marvel had, those characters all drew me. All that said, DC, so like, in general, I like Marvel better, but DC's dark corners are better than Marvel's dark corners. So like, Swamp Thing, Deadman, Spectre, those kind of characters are all, those creepy characters are better than Marvel's creepy characters. So I love those. I love those a lot. So like, I couldn't really care about the Flash or Superman when I was a kid, but I really loved Warlord and Deadman and those oddball characters that DC had. So that, all that said, it's pretty much a wash. But as far as me as an adult now, I still love those Marvel characters, but I like working at DC better. DC is just, it runs a little bit, they run a little bit tighter ship as far as like how they handle their creators.
Excellent. Any other questions? Oh, yes. So who are your favorite, who's your favorite character in Marvel and in DC?
That's hard for me to answer because I have some favorites that are like my favorite to read and then my favorite to create. And they're two. So I'm going to tell you both.
Yes.
my favorite to read when I was a kid was Spider-Man. Definitely Spider-Man. But my favorite to create at Marvel, like if you said you can come write or draw any book at Marvel, it would be Fantastic Four. I would love to write the Fantastic Four. At DC, my favorite character was a character called Ragman. I don't expect anybody to know who I'm talking about. Ragman is my favorite, and I'd love to write and draw Ragman someday. And I also really dig Swamp Thing, and I was lucky that I got a chance to work on Swamp Thing. So that.
Excellent. All right. Well, I'm gonna pull one quick more question because that brought one up to when you said that you'd like to do Ragman. What is your dream project? Like, if you had your choice of being able to write or draw any character, what would it be?
Oh, well, it would be a creator-owned thing, definitely. It would be like something in Image that I wrote and drew. But if you mean like at Marvel or DC, I think I just told you what they would be. Like, I would love to write the Fantastic Four. I mean, I have really strong feelings about the Fantastic Four and what to do with them. And at DC, like I said, I like those dark corners of the DC universe, so I'd like to explore those.
Awesome.
I guess I will give you one last question.
Is the fifth last question.
It is. I assume you have a little bit of time to read for pleasure for yourself. Is there anything out there right now that you would like to plug that you just find amazing that you don't think is getting the recognition that it deserves?
Yeah, there's a ton of stuff. Probably the most exciting artist out right now is this kid named Daniel Warren Johnston. Johnson. And he does a book at Image called Extremity, which is sort of like, I don't know, it's mind-blowing. And his work is really incredible. So he's going to be huge. He's already huge, but he's going to be even more huge very soon. So Daniel Warren Johnson's Extremity is something I think people should be checking out.
Very good.
All right. Well, I think that'll draw us to a close. So before we finish up here, Phil, how can people find you if they want to get in touch with you?
Probably the easiest way is on Twitter. On Twitter, I'm just at Phil Hester, and I try to look at all my mentions. So even if I'm not following you, you can still holler at me, and I'll probably get back to you.
Perfect. And do you have anything coming up in the pipeline you can tell us about real quick here?
Like I said, I'm on Batman Beyond right now and Birdman, both at DC. And then I have a new book coming up from Image in this fall that's written by Jeff Lemire, called The Family Tree. And like I said, that'll probably start coming out in November.
Excellent. All right. Well, it's been an awesome pleasure to get to interview you here at FM Comic-Con. We appreciate you taking the time to sit with us and answer all of our questions.
The best part of this interview is that I can see my table from this interview. So I can see everybody checking out my stuff and then walking away because I'm up here. So it's been
we should have put a sign out there.
I'm over here.
Look here. We'll remember that for next
time. Yeah, I don't want to stop the interview to make change.
Yeah. So, no, just get up and run out there. Yeah. And
hold on, guys. See, like, there's a guy there right now. He's like, I wish I could buy this comic, but oh well.
We're single-handedly destroying your financial future.
No, that's okay.
Well, thanks again for being on here. Thank you, audience, for coming out and being a part of this panel. We will be taking a moment to go through, and if you have a trivia sheet that you filled out and have not turned into us, please do that, and we'll grade those, and then we'll announce who got the top honors there, and then everybody, of course, will have a chance to grab a prize from the wonderful prize bag, thanks to Paradox Comics and Cards. So thank you again, and we'll be back in just
a
minute.
Thank you.
This was a Doxcast. Hope you think it rocks, cast. Oh, look at the clocks, cast. Until next time.